Welcome to the one show that takes you where others won't. Out into the wilderness. Past the frontiers of what you thought was possible. With your own personal guide, the Pilgrim on the 405, Will Christ.
Well, welcome to Pilgrim Talks on this wonderful, beautiful afternoon in Southern California, and especially in Laguna Beach. One of the things that's been on the minds of lots of people is how do we get new jobs? How do we build up jobs? How do we make the transition from the world that we knew before into the world that's coming? And one of the ways that we do that is to capitalize on the entrepreneurial skills, on the inventive skills, on people starting new businesses, solving new problems, creating new opportunities to solve problems. And as we do that, we build new businesses. Now, sometimes we could think of that taking a long time to build. And that's when we begin to think about how do we accelerate that growth process? How do we accelerate the time from the idea to the execution of that idea and presenting it to the marketplace? Sometimes in today's environment, when the distance between the idea and the execution is too long, the people who came up with the idea lose the momentum, they lose the incentive, they're not first to market, somebody might steal it, technology might change, all sorts of things happen to make the initial investment of time, money, and resources worthless. So when I come across somebody like the folks over at K5, I get excited. K5 is an accelerator, and it's not just an accelerator for new businesses run by somebody who's run businesses. This is an accelerator run by angel investors and experienced business people, and what their task is to do is to help emerging entrepreneurs build successful technology-driven companies that get to market first with their ideas. Now, the first step in becoming a part of the K5 group is to apply. And while applications for this year's class are closed, next year's class, they're beginning to look for new people. We have tonight one of the partners of K5. This is Kai Tao, and he's an experienced technology investor. He's invested for a long time through Park One Capital, which is his family, and they invest in both private and public equities, and they have a number of different capital structures, which works perfectly when we're trying to help new entrepreneurs and business startups move into the marketplace, because as we know now, capital structures are very fluid, very flexible, and there's a new one every day. So Park One Capital seeks to find these innovative, disruptive business opportunities. Those are the ones they back. They work actively with entrepreneurs, and they create value because they can leverage the many years of industry and financial relationships that they have built. I'm looking forward to the interview with Kai tonight, because this is going to be very interesting for people who have new ideas and who want to get into the marketplace but maybe don't know how or don't want to face all the challenges alone. So welcome, Kai.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about what Park One Capital is.
So Park One Capital is my family investment vehicle, and as you so ably described it, it was an investment vehicle we created to participate in both public and private investment opportunities. And so naturally, over the course of a long investment career, you've had your share of successes and failures. And over time, what you do is you start identifying what you see key qualities of success and identifying which entrepreneurs to back. And hopefully, you know, learn from your mistakes and capitalize on your success and grow on them and build upon them over time through an ecosystem of alumni relationships. And so, you know, part of the excitement was coming to Orange County. I'm originally from New York City, and we've had a vacation home out in Southern California for many years, and basically never had a chance to spend a little more time out here, even though I was coming out west a lot for short trips. And so when I came out to the West Coast, you know, I was trying to get back to the East Coast, but I kept on getting snowed out. And so naturally, you get spoiled with the wonderful lifestyle that we share over here. And I wanted to have a chance to meet like-minded entrepreneurs and angel investors. So the first thing I did was I kind of cold-called all the local investing organizations to try to get a better understanding of what was available in Orange County. And what I found was that there wasn't any particular organizations in terms of angel organization really actively investing, with the exception of Text Coast Angels, which I was fortunate enough to get involved with in terms of meeting some of the members within Text Coast Angels. One of the members is my current partner, Amir, who is one of our founders of K5. And he and I started working together when we started working on the TED conference. Amir had gotten the license for an innovative conference called TED, which stands for Technology, Entertainment, and Design. And the main conference is based on Long Beach, but Amir got the license for a spin-out organization. So we put on the conference last May in Orange County, where we had over 1,200 attendees. And the whole conference was about promoting innovation and education, and essentially bringing thought leaders together in one location so we can all share ideas and promote the future. And so fortunately, we had a good crowd and for a first-time endeavor, and a stellar list of speakers. And so everyone really enjoyed their experience. And afterwards, Amir and I started talking about what the next step was in terms of how are we going to bring and keep innovation to Orange County and Southern California more than what's been done before. And so Amir introduced me to my other two partners in K5, Ray Chan and David Chen. And essentially, these were all entrepreneurs who have worked with other companies and have invested privately, you know, as an angel, both with Tech Coast Angels and separately as individuals. And so we kind of banded together to kind of think about what it took to create success and what type of environment we wanted to see in Orange County. And what we recognized was that a lot of good ideas were being formed in Orange County, but people were taking those ideas and going out to other geographies, such as Northern California and New York City, because that's where the funding was, and that's where the support structure was. And so we recognized that in order for us to be successful, what we had to create was an organization, K5, that would promote this innovation and ecosystem of investment climate and helping entrepreneurs locally. And so we would attract the best talent locally, give them the support necessary, and that way they don't have to venture off to other geographies, make their fortunes with the other geographies, and then move back after to Orange County to retire. And so we were committed towards doing this, and essentially that's what the beginnings of the K5 movement was created.
All right. So what does that mean now that you have the K5 movement here? Tell us what that's going to do in Orange County.
So K5 was kind of an ambitious name that Amir came up with, which stands for Influencing the Creation of 1,000 Companies Over 5 Years. So what essentially, it's a two-phase sense, in the sense that we're creating a greater movement of innovation in the sense that we want to encourage job creation and startups to be located in Orange County. And then the K5 venture is essentially our accelerator program, where we will select companies that fit our profile and help them accelerate to a level where they will be accepted by other angel investors and other venture investors that we've worked with over the past, so that we can accelerate their growth. And so they can focus on operating the business and creating innovation rather than spending a lot of time on pure fundraising. One of the most tedious parts of being an entrepreneur is, you know, you write a business plan and you go around knocking on all doors, friends and family, and any prior relationship that you have, to try to get the basic seed funding to test out your idea. So what happens a lot of times is you send a business plan out and you hope to raise capital. But by the time you've raised all the capital, you find that the idea has already gotten past where it needs to be. So you've missed your window of opportunity. So in terms of what we're trying to create with the accelerator is we're encouraging entrepreneurs to just, you know, if they have a good idea that we believe makes sense, to just be in a position where we will help them jump in right away in terms of testing out the viability of this concept and this idea, so that the marketplace will determine whether this idea has any potential for future success. And if it doesn't, what are the necessary steps to adjust so that we can respond to where the market wants to go? I can't tell you how many times in my investment career where I've invested in a business plan because the idea sounds good, and then once we start going, we realize that the marketplace has changed, especially in technology where things change on a rapid basis. You have to respond to the market. You can't dictate to the market what the market wants. You have to gradually test out your thesis. And when you finally find a thesis that actually works
and apply, that's when you step on the gas pedal. That's when you throw the additional investment growth capital to really scale the business. Too many businesses in the past that we find the biggest mistake is that they raise a lot of capital, they throw a lot of dollars into building something that the marketplace doesn't necessarily want. So by the time you've created this perfect widget or this perfect system and you've spent, you know, the hundreds of thousands and millions of dollars, then you find out that the marketplace doesn't exist. And what happens is you've now blown most of your capital that you've raised, so you don't have the ability to adjust. And when you don't have the ability to adjust, that's your one shot. You've missed it. And your investors are not going to back you for another shot because you failed on your first shot. And so what happens is too many companies spend the money and scale before they have a concept that's proven, that has the viability. So we take it from an approach that we're going to identify what all the risk points are and test out what those risk points are to try to minimize them, and then give you the opportunity to demonstrate metrics that we mutually determine will tell us whether this idea has a viability concept or not, and then decide how we're going to move forward in the future.
Well, all right, so now who should be talking to you right now? Well, you've closed your class for this year, right?
Well, we're going to, our first class is pretty much closed right now. We're going to be launching sometime in the next 2 weeks, but we'll be accepting a second class in the second half of the year as well. You know, we're right now we're very focused on the first class, and what we're trying to do is promote innovation locally in Orange County. And to give you an example, what we did to assemble our class was we had to get the word out that something like K5 existed in Orange County. So what we've been doing is we've been putting on mixers where our monthly events, where we gather together any potential individual that's interested in being an entrepreneur. In addition, what we've been doing is going actively to the local student community in Chapman University, UCI, et cetera, and participating as mentors and judges in the entrepreneur competition. And what we're trying to do is we're trying to identify talented teams, because one of the secrets for success is we find that today's innovation happens so quick and there's so much pressure that one individual to bear that burden is very difficult. So we're looking for teams of entrepreneurs with complementary skills. Because a lot of times as investors, what we accept is that the idea will change, but the key thing is to find the right team, because the right team will have the necessary skill sets and the adaptability to be able to adjust to whatever opportunity comes forward. I'll give you an example. Who would have thought that Apple and Android today would completely displace the market that BlackBerry used to be in? You know, BlackBerry at one point owned 90% of the smartphone market, and today they're under 20%, all within a short span of 2 years. So just imagine the entrepreneur that created, you know, the best plan in the world to create apps for the BlackBerry, a platform that was dominant, and all of a sudden they spent all this time investing in the BlackBerry, and they realize that the market's now going in other directions and other platforms. You know, it's too late to adjust. So part of it is kind of finding, if we find the right team who is very attuned to what's going on with the market and have the complementary skill sets to work together and to support each other during a period, because, you know, during this accelerator phase, it's almost like intensive boot camp. So it will be as close to a 24/7 experience as you can get. I mean, sleep is really going to be a difficult part of the process, because, you know, you're essentially working on your prototype and trying to get it to a working model, and then getting it ready for demo day so we can go test it out with customers and introducing it to necessary investors. So to answer your question in terms of what types of people should apply, I think what we're trying to do is to get people with a good idea and necessarily find a team of folks, friends or colleagues, who can, you know, provide complementary skill sets so that they'll necessarily have both the business skills and the technical vision to execute their idea. And we're doing our part to support that by sponsoring these mixers, where we call them co-founder mixers, where people can meet together and share ideas and find co-founders that they want to work with. And then as we build these teams apply for the K5 movement, and we evaluate their concept and help them along the way, and hopefully pick the right groups of people that we want to back and succeed.
All right, so what happens then when they get in? How large are the classes?
So the classes right now we're intentionally keeping small, because we want to have intensive mentor time between the four partners of K5 as well as the mentors that we've recruited. So we'll probably have about five companies for our first class and keep it around that size until we get everything moving. The first class will be located actually at a physical space right next to Chapman University in Orange. So we have a six-bedroom house, which will be a working office for our companies and for all the mentors to get together. So we're going to be there to really support and work on these companies and work on their products throughout the course of the program. The course of the program will last approximately between 12 to 16 weeks. And essentially, during this period of time, we're going to spend the first month in terms of refining and testing the product and the interface so that it's ready to go to market. We'll spend the second month going to the market and testing it out to see whether the assumptions done in the product can be verified. And then we'll spend the last month really basically wrapping up the package of the company to position themselves for other angel investors and venture investors. And so the key is, as an angel investor and a venture investor, what you're looking for is momentum and acceleration in terms of your ideas. And so what we hope to provide to our classes is designing over the course of, you know, the first 4 to 8 weeks, a product that we can go test the market and demonstrate that there's clear momentum in terms of whatever metrics we identify as being applicable for the business model. So, for example, if you're creating a product that is demonstrated by users and usage, we want to test it out by seeing how many users are signing up for your product and how long are they staying on to use the product. You know, so each company is going to have a different set of metrics, and each company will necessarily have a different set of business models. And so we have to identify as mentors and work with the companies to pick the right business model, the right metrics to position the companies for a demo day when we unveil what we've accomplished with minimal capital over a 3 to 4 month period. And so when that day happens, we go to the investors and we tell the story and say, hey, with minimal capital and minimal time, this team has been able to execute successfully and work together hard over such a short period of time and develop a product that the market appears to want. And so with more capital and more support, we expect this success to accelerate even faster. That's why you should invest in the company. And so it's a story that we package for the investor base. And, you know, that's part of what the accelerator stands for and how we hope to help the companies.
All right. So is having a marketing plan and a sales plan, are those important things before you go to angel investors?
I think angel investors, you know, angel investing has changed over time. In the past, angel investors would just invest in what appears to be a good idea. And the whole idea was that you would take, you know, you've exited in your professional life, you know, and you have excess cash that you want to bet on a good idea. And right now it's very sexy to hear all the new ideas that are out there. So what happens is you necessarily will spread it, and then you don't really get actively involved with the company anymore, and you hope that it becomes successful. And so what usually happens is that when you spend minimal time working with the companies and you're basically just betting on what you think is a good idea, the result is usually not as favorable as you would like it. You know, I found in my experience when I first started investing, I would look at a lot of concepts that I thought were great ideas. I'd write them a check, even if it was a small check, and I would just hope that it would work because I thought it was a good idea, but the marketplace didn't necessarily think it was a good idea. And so over time, the best angel investors have taken it to a next level in the sense that they want to see a product idea that can be tested and verified. So when you talk about a marketing plan and a sales plan, these things are subject to change as you deal with the realities of the market. However, you need to have an initial concept to work with to go along with the product. So when we look at a product for its viability, we're trying to figure out the user experience. We're trying to figure out exactly what will attract, based upon our prior experience level in attracting users and customers to the product, what will get people excited. And so as an initial attempt, we'll work with the companies to try to create that necessary business model, user interface, and user experience to get the customer excited about it. And then we're testing it out with market to see whether what the response rate is going to be. You know, everything sounds promising on paper, and then all of a sudden you deal with reality. And if good fortune happens and you happen to, you know, guess correctly and test it correctly, you actually see immediate traction. But for most companies, a lot of times they try one or two times before they finally hit on the business model and the idea that will work. And so it's kind of a self-discovery process. We're just trying to institutionalize and guide that process with our companies and working with the founders so that it will save time and energy.
Okay. So will you help them put together that sales and marketing plan, the sales marketing plans?
I mean, that's one of the services that we provide, but generally companies come with an idea in terms of what, you know, they're trying to accomplish. You know, for example, you know, we've had we had over 200 plus applicants for our first class. We're working probably with approximately five companies out of the 200. So a lot of the, I can't say, you know, there was a lot of good ideas out of the 200 companies. So how do we differentiate between the companies that we selected that we're going to work with and the companies that we did not? You know, part of it is the question of what can we accomplish over the 3 to 4 months. We have to make sure that we have the necessary relationships in our network where we can directly influence their business. For example, if they're attacking XYZ industry vertical and I happen to have a lot of relationships in that vertical, then naturally that's a company that I would gravitate to want to work with, because I could easily pick up a phone and call a bunch of my friends who have had prior relationships and who know me and have had successful you know, investments working with me to at least give this chance a company to the company to pitch their idea and to implement and test out their product. So a lot of it is based upon, you know, the type of relationships that we have. A lot of it is based upon whether we can influence that change over 3 to 4 months, because there are a lot of good ideas that might take a year to play out, but you're not going to find out results for a year or 2 years. And so I would say those companies would be a little more premature, because you know, we're trying to help them accelerate it rather than to wait. So companies that might not necessarily fit today might fit a year from now or 2 years from now when they get to that point where it can be ready for testing by the market. So when you actually say about what we're trying to do, is we are helping and advising them, but usually the entrepreneurs have a vision when they pitch us. They're telling us, this is the product that we've created, this is what we've accomplished, this is the team of what we've established, and this is how we propose to market. And we'll go and argue and debate in them to try to test a lot of their assumptions as an initial, you know, gut check, and ask them a lot of questions and see how they respond to them, to see whether they've considered all the possibilities. After we're done with that process, then we'll mutually work together to create a marketing plan that we agree on that we want to execute within the given time frame, and which metrics we're going to use to determine whether we're successful or not successful. And that's an ongoing process where we're working hand in hand with the co-founders of the company.
What's the nature of the companies that you're looking for? Are most of these companies marketing and selling online?
I wouldn't say it's marketing and selling, but I would say that they are software-related business. So they could apply to mobility, they could apply to on the desktop, but they're generally dealing directly with the consumer or directly business-to-business, and it's directly a technology-slash-software-related business. And a lot of the concepts and ideas that we work with are disruptive in the sense that they're changing the way people are currently doing this. I'll give you an example. One of the companies we're working with has created a social tool where you're able to promote the activities that you're doing when you're going to a certain city. For example, if you want to go to Las Vegas, and you would post on Facebook and Twitter that you would that you're going to go there, and that if any of your friends want to come, you know, you would basically announce it. So then let's say all of a sudden none of your other friends decide that they want to go to Vegas too. So every time you're posting and you're tweeting about your activities, you know, you're getting credit and you're accumulating points. And that currency is a reward for posting and tweeting, and can be translated into free meals, free rooms, et cetera. And so, you know, that's a disruptive, fun environment where everyone wins, in the sense that the hospitality company is happy because they're getting customers that they didn't have beforehand. You're happy because you're basically telling your friends about your activities and where you're going to go. So there's a social element about it. But at the same time, you're also getting a benefit, because the more people you bring along, the more points you accumulate, which can translate into free rooms and free food, et cetera. And so this is a concept that we think is going to be very disruptive, and we've been testing it in the market, and the initial response has been pretty good. And so that's the kind of ideas where these are all using technology as an enabler, as a tool to disrupt your daily life of how you conduct your business and how you conduct your personal activities to make a change for the better without dramatically altering your lifestyle, but using this technology as a facilitator for it.
Well, is that what you just talked about? Is that anything like PlanCast? I mean, they just stopped working because what was it essentially it started off to be a good idea that people would put their plans out. They're going to be at this conference or go here or go there. Basically about conferences, or I'm going to be in the city making this presentation. You know, after the initial early adopters, nobody else really used it.
Well, in this case, the reason why it's been successful is because, number one, it's done as an individual basis and not as a corporate basis. And so, essentially, it's designed to be a social tool for you to access your network of friends. Okay. Number two, it's because if you were going to plan a trip to go with your friends in the first place, you would have planned it and gone somewhere and spent all this money without getting any additional benefit. Now you utilize the social tool, and because you're utilizing the social tool, you're actually getting benefits in terms of tangible products. You're getting room upgrades. You're getting room discounts. You're getting free rooms, free meals, et cetera, et cetera. And so the users who utilize the product come back again and again. Every single time they want to plan a trip or do something that takes more than themselves or with their friends when they're gathering, it makes sense for them to utilize it because they're seeing a tangible benefit from it. And naturally, their friends see the same tangible benefit. So gradually what happens is you have a viral effect that expands and continues to grow. And then the companies get very excited about it because they're having access to customers that they didn't have access beforehand. So when you have a situation where it's a win-win-win on all sides, then everyone's happy and it becomes a recursive thing where you want to continue promoting it. But these are the things where we've had initial success, and so we want to continue to see how as it rolls out and as we scale and go nationally with more partners and more places and more industry verticals, you know, we have to test it to see whether we can recreate the success and continue to expand the success going forward.
Good. Kai, can you stick around after the break and talk a little bit more about what do you see going on in the marketplace?
Sure.
Absolutely. Good. Super. Well, let's take a break here and hear from our friends over at Sandler Training.
Hi, I'm Gary Harvey with Sandler Training. I'm here to discuss with you today rule number four, a decision not to make a decision is making a decision. Have you gone out shopping for something, you had a salesperson show you whatever it is you're looking for, and you really have an interest to buy, but you're not really sure. Flip side, you may actually realize you really don't want to buy it, but you don't want to hurt their feelings. So you use the most proverbial words in sales that salespeople don't want to hear, but they're willing to accept, called the proverbial think it over. I'm a firm believer in all the salespeople that I have coached throughout my career, that really is a code for the word a slow no. I had a client recently that was proposing a fairly large project to a prospect. Prospect said, gee, it looked interesting. We have a lot of interest in what you're offering. And by the way, we really like you. So one of the things that made him feel like I've got it. So they said, let us get back to you the next week. But this looks really good, but we do need to think it over. We're a firm believer at Sandler Training that if it's going to be a think it over, 9 out of 10 times, it's going to be a no, but they don't want to tell you that. We're also firm believers that if it's going to be a no, we all know this intellectually, don't we? We want to know right up front. But emotionally, we don't want to hear those words. So plant your feet, stand your ground, and be willing to say to a potential client, with all due respect, Mr. and Mrs. Prospect, that decision not to make a decision really is making a decision. And it's a no in my world, and it's okay to tell me that.
All right, so we've been speaking with Kai Tao, one of the partners over at K5, which is an interesting endeavor to accelerate growth in Orange County, help companies that might be tempted to look other places for funding in those initial steps, rather than go up to Silicon Valley or to Austin, Texas, or to Boston or New York. Why not stay right here where we have so much innovation, so much innovative power, and such great schools and such great support? Why not make that possible for people to stay here? Is that right, Kai?
That's correct.
So tell us a little bit about how you see the marketplace today.
Well, I think in terms of going back to the ecosystem, I mean, right now we're at an opportunity where the cost of starting a new business, especially in the technology field, are lower and lower. We're having an infrastructure that is here, which did not exist 10 years ago. So if you look at the development of the internet and the opportunity, a lot of the most successful companies today are utilizing the same concepts that were applied 10 years ago, except at that time, the cost to create a new business was much higher, and the infrastructure was certainly not there. I mean, there was no broadband. Everyone was still on dial-up, and there was certainly no mobility going on in the world. So today, you have an opportunity where you have smartphones that have faster access to the internet than people were having back in the year 2000. And so that brings around a tremendous amount of opportunity because the phone and mobility that's attached to you is essentially your new computer. And it allows capabilities such as location, identification, and individual personification based upon your interest directed towards each phone, which is something that you carry and you utilize every day. You're seeing opportunities. You know, the reason why there's such change going on is, you know, Best Buy, for example, you take a look at all these retailers. The retailers were always very successful because they had the necessary footprint. And it was a big box retailer that you went there and you knew you'd find the finest access to product and you'd be able to buy what you needed and it would be able to deliver you a customer experience that you respected and that you enjoyed. But if you look at shopping habits today, why there's such a tremendous opportunity, today you have a situation where I, the customer, go to a store like Best Buy. And instead of buying the product from Best Buy, I go and identify and I test out all the products that I want. And then I utilize my mobile phone to identify the product unit. And then I send it on the internet to go price comparison to see who has the cheapest offering for the same product. And then I hit the purchase button and all of a sudden, you know, I buy it at the best cost and Best Buy loses that sale. You know, you take that the same analogy over to books. You know, you might go to Barnes & Noble to go test out the book, to read it partially, or to find out exactly what it is. But then you know you can buy it on Amazon for 30% less. So as you see this bifurcation of an online-offline world, people are gradually trying to figure out. It becomes very disruptive, and there's a lot of opportunities to capture the new customer because this new customer is an intelligent customer that goes and researches what they purchased before they buy, and now they have a lot of options, and that option is quite mobile that goes along with it. Another example is because you have a mobile phone that's attached to you, you have the opportunity now to have personalized offers attached to you. And so, for example, if you have a restaurant that is generally at full price and full capacity, and all of a sudden they have a slow period between the hours of 3 to 6, and they want to attract customers, they can direct a specialized offer to your individual phone based upon your proximity to that restaurant, say, hey, all of a sudden we have a 50% off happy hour special between the hours of 3 to 6. And if you happen to be in the area and you're thirsty or something or you're a bunch of friends, you might elect to go there. So there's a whole realm of possibilities that are going on because, you know, once again, the infrastructure is now there. And the cost today with the cloud, you know, you have all these hosting companies. Instead of having to go out and buy all these hardware, you know, you can actually outsource a lot of the major developments of what you need to purchase to these established companies at minimal cost. And they'll even provide you free service in the beginning so to get you started. And because they're willing to bet on you for the future in the hope that you'll scale, you know, that means you can now launch a technology-based business with minimal capital, which leads back to the accelerator. Because now we have an opportunity to invest in companies with minimal capital and be able to immediately have what we call an MVP, a minimal viable product, that goes out to the marketplace to test out, see whether people are actually interested and will actually utilize the product. And once we know for sure that there's enough interest, then we can necessarily accelerate that growth by supplying more additional capital to basically replicate the formula in more spots or continue to expand and bring the necessary talent to continue to scale the business. And that's why we're in a tremendous period of opportunity right now. This is something that could not have existed, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago. But we're in a very disruptive environment where business models are being changed, where people are completely mobile, where business is all being mobile and information is all around you. And what happens when information is all around you and easily accessible to people is that you start cutting out the middlemen. And so there's going to be a lot of disruptive opportunities in providing services in a freemium model that previously you paid a middleman for. You know, take example, you know, in the real estate market, you know, right now you can find out what all the houses priced around you are based upon publicly available data and have all that data supplied to your phone. But all of a sudden, the edge that a broker had beforehand in commanding a, you know, a large commission, you know, is different now because customers are much more aware of what the marketplace is like. And so we're going to see a lot of disruptive opportunities like this in multiple industries. And that's why it's such a good investment climate right now, because people with expertise, especially in this particular industry verticals that they're in, they're the best positioned people to disrupt their own industry because they know what the weak spots are and what the areas that people want in terms of their own customers. So they can supply that need. They're able to create a new marketplace that didn't exist beforehand, utilizing tools that weren't available beforehand and creating a lot of innovation and success for everyone to enjoy.
So what, how do you, you know, what do you, how should we respond to industries that are being disrupted when they charge the disruptors with theft and, you know, IP, stealing IP? I mean, you know, what should we do? You know, SOPA and PIPA don't seem to be an adequate response. But
well,
what
if,
should
if
we
look,
be doing?
I mean, I really think disruption works both ways. You can either fight against it or you can embrace it. It's almost like when you're in a business, you have two choices when a competitor shows up. You can either cannibalize your own business and create and go along with the new business, or you can let someone else do it to you. And so the realities of capitalism in the marketplace is change is going to happen with or without you. And so if you're in a position to create change and you understand the marketplace, then now is the greatest time to change for you to participate in and bring a service that, you know, that the average customer was not aware of beforehand, but all of a sudden when they encounter, they're going to think it's the greatest thing, you know, known to mankind. You know, when you address in terms of intellectual property, you know, I think this goes beyond intellectual property, because obviously as software providers, you know, intellectual property is something that needs to be protected. Rule of law needs to be protected. That's why the United States is as successful as this, and why the capitalism system is so successful here, because we're not the Wild West. We have rules that we follow and we protect it. However, when you have old industries trying to blockade new ideas from being formed because they're afraid of their new businesses, you know, if you look at a lot of the old leaders, if they had embraced a lot of their competitors ahead of time, either by partnering with them or acquiring those technologies or moving forward, then they would be in position to be the continued leader of today. But instead, they don't. They fight against it as much as they can. They use legal battles. They use, you know, marketplace, you know, muscle. But the problem is when you're defending something that doesn't make sense, that the consumer doesn't want or has moved beyond, you can only defend it for that long before the market disappears. And then the new guy who's creating the market, he's embracing all that market share that should rightfully be yours. And so I think the key question is whether you want to embrace innovation or you want to fight it. If you want to fight innovation, it's a losing battle because this change is going to happen with or without you. And there's so many, if you look at corporate history, it's happened over and over again. And that's part of the beauty of capitalism and the beauty of innovation in the United States is that every decade there's a new leader. If you think about it, Yahoo started off as the leader in the late 90s. They had multiple opportunities to purchase Google, which is doing something that was completely disruptive called search. And Yahoo's like, oh, well, we're just going to license it. We're not going to pay much attention. All of a sudden, Google becomes the leader. Who also would have thought in a world that Microsoft had complete monopoly control that they would be offset by the cloud and by the internet and by companies like Facebook and Google? And so it's just the beauty of the system. It's almost Darwinian in the sense that change is going to happen, and you might have controlling market share at this moment, but if you're not adapting with the environment and adapting to what the customers want, you're going to lose the status, and that allows the new company to come from nowhere and build a viable business. So as angel investors and as professional investors, we want to participate in identifying those disruptors and those companies and backing them and giving them the necessary tools to create a viable brand new enterprise.
Well, all right. So at what point does disruptive become theft?
Explain what theft would be in this sense, because if I'm creating, for example, if I'm creating a tool set to give the customer the best pricing option that's out there, and he elects to choose to purchase from XYZ merchant because it's providing the best value to them versus something that they used to overpay by 50% for, is that considered a theft? Or is that considered providing information that wasn't available beforehand and access to a customer base that wasn't there beforehand?
Well, if allegedly, Mega Upload was providing a place, a platform, for people to massively share videos without paying for it.
You know,
now, that's certainly disruptive.
Mega, sure. And I would say it's I'm not here to argue because I'm not a lawyer in that sense, and I have a lot of investment in companies with intellectual property. So it's very important for me that companies are able to retain their intellectual property. And, you know, so I'm not in a position really to comment on companies like Mega Upload. But if you take a look at companies like YouTube as well, you know, YouTube historically in the beginning, there was a lot of quote-unquote pirated material that appeared on YouTube. And so the intellectual, the IP owners who owned it tried to stop it and tried to shut it down. And so that's essentially what happened. They shut it down in the beginning. And what they found was that, first of all, they can't police everything. So every time they shut it down, something would happen again. Okay, so then how did they begin to respond? They decided to embrace it as a tool. So instead of shutting down, you know, YouTube by itself, they decided to appoint official channels in YouTube where they can actually participate in the growth of YouTube and that audience and figure out how to monetize that audience through the form of advertising and other revenue sources. So I'm not in a position to argue in terms of, you know, what is we have the laws for a reason, and, you know, the court system will determine whether what Mega Upload did was legal or not legal, or whether some of these other form of technology is legal or not legal. But the one thing that is been shown over and over again is, in the beginning, if you think about it, the tape recorder, when you recorded something for your own private consumption, that was considered piracy, and that was considered illegal. And so all these companies, you know, the media companies over time and time again have tried to stop innovation. And then, you know, Apple comes along, comes out with a legal form of iTunes in terms of purchasing media content, and they become the largest seller of media in the world, you know, multiple billions of dollars. And so, you know, again, there are legal ways to pursue that. I'm not a lawyer, so I'm not in a position to comment on these things. But what I can say is that the companies who have continued to embrace these new disruptive channels have continued to capitalize and become successful in a legal fashion. If you look at Apple, the reason that they are now the most valuable company in the world was because they embraced disruption and they were able to provide a tool set that allowed the customer to legally purchase all that intellectual content in a method that was easy for the customer to embrace. And so everyone benefited because, you know, the record companies and intellectual property owners had access to sales that they never had beforehand. Apple was able to sell a lot of hardware. The customer was able to buy a product that they wanted that they were going to utilize in a portable fashion. So it becomes a win-win-win. You know, in YouTube right now, you know, CBS and all these other major providers are providing official channels, you know, where they promote their artists, and they found ways to monetize it through advertising and also through increased music tour sales and merchandising, et cetera. So, you know, while Mega Upload is an extreme situation, and the court system will determine exactly what will happen with them, I think that over history, if you look at it, over time, you know, the customers are going to embrace some form of disruption, and the companies that continue to adjust to it and adapt to the new business model are able to capitalize and survive for the next generation.
Yeah, but isn't it interesting that that part of Apple's move was to eliminate digital rights management for music?
Well, they could not have done digital rights management removal without the backing of all the labels.
Yeah.
And so if you think about it, why did the labels start backing them? Because the labels realized that just fighting piracy by itself ultimately is going to be a losing battle, because there's always someone out there that will do something that you can't police. So what you want to do is you want to provide a product that is of tremendous value. A 99-cent music track is of tremendous value to an individual who can listen to that music over and over and again. It's not overpriced. It's a reasonably priced product. And so Apple was very successful because when they did that, they found out that the average customer actually purchased much more tracks. You know, it's kind of ironic that even though each track is 99 cents, you buy 100 tracks, that's $100 that you just spent, you know, $99 you just spent. And so what happens is by embracing an environment in a format that the customer can appreciate and packaging it in a nice environment, everyone was able to win. Now take it, it took Apple to have the vision and Steve Jobs to necessarily convince all the labels that we can pull this off. You know, all these other people have tried it beforehand and it hasn't necessarily succeeded. Because people were, you know, they were getting resistance. There's bureaucracy. If you think about these large companies, I mean, think about it. Sony should have had this whole market because Sony had the Walkman, and everyone used the Walkman, and they also had their own music content company where they controlled all the rights of Columbia. But what happened was Columbia would fight against the Sony hardware division. There was no one voice, one message, one company. And so when you're having so many internal battles, the company that should have won the war was Sony, and they gave all the business away to Apple. And that's why Apple's the most valuable company in the world today.
Yeah, and that certainly seems to be true with this whole movement toward the apps, where we are moving away from boxed software or even downloaded software, you know, that's multiple gigabytes of data. And now we have an app, what, 99 cents, and all these things are available.
And the ironic thing with apps is there's actually become less piracy when you have stuff like apps because you actually have to purchase it directly from Apple directly. So in the past, you would go to a store. If you wanted to borrow someone's CD, let's say I was buying XYZ Office or something, you'd buy someone's borrow someone's CD-ROM and load it to your computer. And you could actually do that with multiple computers. And essentially, that was a form of software piracy. But Apple now controls the App Store, where the only way to get the software is through the App Store. And it's priced at an affordable price that it makes sense for you to purchase it for yourself. And it's individually tied to your computer and to your account. And so, in many ways, they've solved their own problem.
Yeah, and you know, it's kind of interesting to hear today. Allegedly, Chris Dodd said to members of Congress that they weren't going to get any money from Hollywood anymore if they don't. The Hollywood people are going to be watching how they vote on various IP bills.
That's true. I mean, Chris Dodd, ironically, you know, he just went directly from Congress to Hollywood to run the Motion Picture Association and be the head lobbyist there. So he's got a voice in all his relationships. But again, you know, when the radio first came out, there was a blockage from the media guys. Then the television came out, there was blockage. You know, a track recorder, tape recorder, CD player, DVD player, every step of the way, every form of innovation, there was people that tried to stop it. And if you think about it, the technology still got adopted and consumers embraced it. And so the companies that continue to fight it end up, you know, finding that their customer base revolves around them and just starts to walk away and look for alternative sources. The customers, you know, the companies that say, hey, you know, we're going to go with the change and embrace it, they're the ones that continue to grow and are to succeed. So it's very hard to stop change and movement, you know, in the sense that I, as an individual, don't have that power. Very few people have that because, you know, this becomes a grand movement in terms of usage patterns and people like that. Today I was to tell you and your family that you can never use the internet again, your lives would be very different than, you can't just tell someone, you know, we're going to take away your computer. You know, you can never utilize your cell phone again. And these are major disruptive changes that happen that change the way we conduct our lives. And so the people who are able to innovate based upon those changes and move forward, you know, are able to benefit from this. And that's why we think there's going to be a lot of great new companies that are going to be formed, and we want to help support that movement and back them.
Well, you know, part of the response to some of the immigration issues was that documentary movie on the day that no Mexicans came to work, right?
Absolutely correct, yep.
And that was sort of like what Wikipedia and I don't know what, 16,000 other sites did, the day that the internet didn't work. I mean, that's tremendously powerful to demonstrate that.
Well, the thing about the internet is it is a community. So it's not one individual that controls it. It's not even one government anymore that controls it. That's why you've seen such dramatic change, you know, in the Middle East, where you've had totalitarian governments for, what, over the last 50, 60 years? Why is every change happening now? You know, why is democracy spreading throughout the world? It's because the internet is a community. It's an open community, not controlled by one individual, or one company, or one government. And by sharing it, this is what I mean by disruptive change. You know, the youth are growing up taking these tools for granted, things that, you know, you and I adopted because, you know, we're a little older. You know, the teenagers are picking up, you know, very, very early on. I mean, you have 2 or 3 year olds growing up with iPads, knowing how to swipe with their fingers and identifying apps already. It almost seems like it's a much more intuitive form of communication than what people are used to. And so these children are growing up, you know, very technically literate. And as such, they have access to information they didn't have access to before as well. And so everything's dramatically changed. And so that's why you're able to have these movements like the Wikipedia movement to go get SOPA or things like that. It becomes a much community-based and an organized movement in that sense.
So you think in our lifetime we might actually see democracy in the United States?
Yeah, I think in general, education and information creates the greatest democracy out there. And
yeah.
people who have the, you know, are self-aware. You know, we're all humans, and because we're all humans, there's certain rights that we all expect. But a lot of us, you know, are not fortunate enough to know what those rights should be until we see other people have it, and then all of a sudden it becomes, you know, a great egalitarian movement.
Yeah.
And so hopefully everyone, you know, we can continue. Education is so important. And part of what we're trying to do as the K-5 movement is to work with the local educators and the local community to promote this concept of innovation so that students get started early on. You know, when they enter college, if they have a good idea, go and try to enter their, you know, school, local school business plan competition and testing out their ideas and working with their professors to mentor them and working with the greater community. I mean, we want to create this education, entrepreneurism as an educational movement, as an educational process, and get everyone encouraged to go for it and to try for innovation. The old days of just working for a company for 50 years, unfortunately, you know, for your entire career is no longer as applicable in today's society. And so the best way to create security is to create your own security by, you know, promoting innovation.
Well, you know, when I grew up, this was the time of the Sputnik and intense concern about mathematics and science. And we had science fairs. And science fairs were roots to being involved with National Science Association invitations to become part of a lab for a summer, to come to a hospital, to be in these various places where science and mathematics are very important. I wonder if it's time for somebody to come up with the whole idea of maybe we have high school innovation fairs.
I think right now we're having a resurgence of what used to be the Westinghouse competition, now the Intel competition, where high school students now have the opportunity to participate. It's very ironic. Recently, I read about how a 17-year-old has discovered some potential cure for a rare form of cancer. And these are tools that were not available beforehand. But these days, you know, a lot of high schools and magnet schools are being created where these tools are provided for them. And, you know, the college and the universities, if you look at what's being offered right now, you know, take my alma mater, MIT. MIT offers their entire courseware, which is available to every student, to anyone that has access to the internet. So that means someone in a remote part of the world, can, if they have access to the internet, can study the same courseware as someone that attends MIT. Stanford has a similar program. Harvard has a similar program. All the top universities. I mean, basically, if you look at it, there's a great disbursement of knowledge and promotion of that knowledge. And then what the local mentors and the local professors and the people who are community-based are, you know, they can apply their life experience to how we can leverage that knowledge and put it towards positive use.
Is that coming through iTunes U, or is that privately branded?
iTunes U is one of the services that you can utilize. You can also, on YouTube, there's a lot of instructional information. Or if you go to directly to the university's website, the open courseware is available.
Khan University as well?
Oh, yes. Khan University is a fantastic program. And again, it provides, I frankly wish that there was a Khan University when I was a kid, because you know, sometimes I didn't have the best instructors, and Mr. Khan is able to explain things in very easy ways that I wish I had. So sometimes for fun, you know, I view those videos as well, just to brush up on some old skills and say, man, God, I wish I had an instructor like that.
Right. That's right. Well, listen, this has been a lot of fun. I really, really appreciate your taking some time to be with us, Kai, and we wish you the best, not the best of luck, but the best of results with your first team of five. Now, when are you looking for the next group?
We'll probably look for 6 months from now, so probably around the June timeframe.
What should people do?
If you go to our website, it's k5launch.com, and what we encourage is we'll be posting up updates as we move forward, and we'll also be posting up when we'll have the next mixer and meeting. So we would encourage anyone that's interested in doing a startup to come to one of our mixers, potentially meet the other partners of K5 as well as other co-founders that you might want to work with in creating and executing your own business idea.
Do you have a place up there for people to add their name so they get the notices via email of the mixers?
I believe we do. We have a subscription list.
Good. Excellent. Well, is there anything else you'd like to tell our listeners as we finish up?
Yes, I just wanted to thank everyone for listening in and for you hosting us for today, because I think this is part of the educational process. And so we're very excited in getting the local community involved. And thank you again.
Yeah, and just to let you know, there's another innovative startup. Who will be the second show that's on Skitcher? Do you know Skitcher?
Is that the podcast program?
Yes,
company?
Yes.
Yes, a friend of mine started that company. And again, you know, one final word to add is the reason why companies in other geographies have succeeded is because when they succeeded and sold their companies, they reinvest in the next startup. And so the guys at Stitcher actually came from, he used to work at StubHub, which they exited and sold to eBay. And after they sold that, he took the proceeds and got a group of investors who had previously worked with him at StubHub to start Stitcher. And so that's how you get constant innovation. The existing entrepreneurs who succeed mentor the next generation and reinvest in their local geography.
Well, we'll give you a call and we'll get his name and maybe you can introduce me and we'll have him on the show.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Thank you, Kai. Take care.
Take care. Bye.
Well, you are seeing the early beating hearts of an entrepreneurial accelerator in Southern California, Orange County. And these are the kind of things that will build the infrastructure for the future. How many times have we seen people pick up and move out, move to other places, fantasizing they're going to have a better tax structure, fantasizing they're going to be greater access to capital. There is no place better than Orange County to live. There's no place better than Orange County to find innovative, creative support mechanisms for startups. With the kind of work that the K5 team is doing, is laying out for us ways to access capital quickly without having to spend a lot of time chasing that capital down. The old model, I've been part of that. I've seen it. And the old model is a lot of PowerPoint presentations, a lot of running around, a lot of schmoozing, and sometimes to no real result, which is extremely disappointing. I think the kind of thing that these guys are doing, which I expect to be duplicated and finding other accelerators getting going, it's more than just an incubator. An incubator is a place for people to get going, and maybe incubator has something to do with 9 months to a year or something about how it gets going. These guys are talking about short term, 12 weeks in a program to get you into a place where you have, what did he say? He said the minimum viable product. So that now we can go quickly to a venture capitalist and show them what we've got and show them the projections, show them the market research we've done, not simply by using data, but by actually going out and taking the product and introducing it into the marketplace. Very innovative, very creative, very supportive. I think these guys are doing a wonderful job for us. It's going to be great to see them in Orange County and to applaud the kind of success they're having. If you haven't gone up to k5launch.com, I encourage you to do it. Take a look at it. I'm sure there is somebody either in your family or in your group of friends who is going to benefit from the kind of work that k5launch.com is doing for Orange County. Great ideas, and they have a great way of helping those ideas become real. So we had a wonderful time getting to know the folks at K5 along the 405. We're looking at talking with more people next week. We look forward to being with you. This is the Pilgrim on the 405. Have a great week.
You're listening to the only show that takes you where others won't. Out into the wilderness, past what you thought was possible. With your own personal guide, the Pilgrim on the 405.